In this hour of Focus 580, we will be talking about the life of Benjamin Franklin. And our guest is Walter Isaacson. He is president of the Aspen Institute. He has been the chairman of CNN and managing editor of Time magazine. And he is the author of a newly published biography of Ben Franklin, which is titled Benjamin Franklin and American Life. The publisher is Simon & Schuster, and it's out here fairly recently. If you're interested in learning more about Mr. Franklin, you can head down to the bookstore and take a look at the book. Questions here on the program also welcome, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So whichever works for you, you can join in the conversation. The only thing we ask of callers is people just try to be brief so we can keep the program moving, but anyone's welcome to join the conversation. Again, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Isaacson, hello.
How's it going?
Good, thanks. And thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, I appreciate it. It's great to be here.
One thing about Franklin, I think, really, that you certainly know and that makes him stand out from the others of the founders is that it seems easier to think of him, to imagine him as a person rather than a statue.
he's pretty flesh and blood,
yeah,
this guy.
Exactly.
I mean, he's got all sorts of quirks, and he's not like George Washington up there on a pedestal. But I sort of feel that's why we can relate to him and we can learn from him. He's sort of the guy who winks at us from history's stage.
Yeah, I like that quote. That was one of the ways that you, one of the lines that you craft for the book, and I think that it's very nice. The idea is that again, as you write in the book, you can kind of imagine sitting down and having a beer with Ben Franklin. You can't, I can't think about sitting down and having a beer with George Washington. It just doesn't work. But Franklin somehow, I think, yes, I actually could do that.
Well, especially because Franklin is one of those, I mean, for better or worse, we can relate to him because he's a little bit like our generation, a little bit entrepreneurial, into the information age, loved gadgets and technology, somewhat ambitious as an urban middle-class entrepreneur trying to start his own business. So I think he certainly speaks to our age.
The other thing about Franklin that I think is striking and it contrasts with the record of some of the other founders is that probably more than any other of this group of men, his image, the way people have thought about him, has gone up and down dramatically over time since he died.
I think it's related a bit to what you said, because we find him so accessible and we see our reflection in him, or the reflection of certain values in him. So in periods when we're very romantic or where the idea of practicality has fallen out of favor and seems like some bourgeois middle-class value, we tend to reject Franklin. I think you find that in the 1820s, 1830s, when you have the transcendental period and the romantic period in America, and people like Emerson and Thoreau and Hawthorne kind of sneered a bit at Benjamin Franklin as being too practical and pragmatic of a guy. And likewise, you find it in the 1920s, a sort of romantic period and wild period of our time. But there are certain times when we have lost track of our basic values, when we've gone through a period in which tolerance and a little bit of humility are what we need, then I think Franklin comes back into favor, and you sort of see that happening now.
Yeah, it's interesting. It does seem to be that when people have criticized Franklin, it has been because they felt that he exemplified more materialist virtues, I guess, rather than spiritual ones. And
that's a good way to put it. But there are two points to be made there. Mm-hmm. First of all, some of those critics confuse Benjamin Franklin with the character he sometimes portrayed of himself in Poor Richard's Almanac or even his autobiography, going around spouting maxims about a penny saved being a penny earned. Let's not forget, this was the most philanthropic of all of our founders. This was the most generous man we had in that century. Here's a guy who decided not to take patents or copyrights on some inventions like the lightning rod or the Franklin stove or bifocals because he felt that it was important to share scientific advances with everybody. Here's a guy who quit his printing business at, you know, age 42 when he's a big success because he wanted to form civic organizations and libraries and universities and stuff. And when his mother wrote him and asked, why are you doing this, he said, I'd rather have it said of me that he lived usefully than that he died rich. So this image of Benjamin Franklin that he sometimes portrays of himself in his Poor Richard's Almanac, all that early to bed and early to rise stuff, you have to realize that's not the real Benjamin Franklin.
Well, that's something, again, about him that maybe gives us an opportunity to connect with him or at least to understand him. His, and I think there's also a nice turn of phrase in the book where you note the fact that he was known as an inventor, but that the most interesting thing he invented was himself. He did craft this image, and although I think one has reason to find some difficulty in separating the image that he crafted and that he gave to us, and separate that from the real Franklin.
Yeah, you know, that's the most interesting thing in trying to be writing about him, because the image becomes part of the reality. Mm-hmm. Take, for example, when he was a young tradesman, he decided he wanted to make a list of the virtues that they had to have in order to be great, you know, young middle-class entrepreneurs. So he makes a list, which is industry and honesty and frugality and all these things, and he practices each one of them and marks them on a chart to see how well he does on each of those virtues. And eventually he masters each of those virtues, and he shows it around to his friends in his little discussion club. And one of them says of him, says to him, you know, you've forgotten a virtue you might want to practice. And Franklin says, what's that? And the friend says, humility. You might want to try practicing that one. And the great thing about Franklin is he said, I was never able to master that virtue. I could never get the reality of humility. But I was very good at giving the appearance of humility, and I found that the appearance of humility was just as useful as the reality of it, because it made you listen to your fellow club members, it made you care about what they thought, it made you make compromises and accommodations and take their opinions into account. And so you see the appearances becoming part of the reality in Franklin as he tries to make himself a more virtuous person.
Mm. I'm thinking of, there's this, in his autobiographies, he tells the story, and you start with it right at the beginning of his arriving when he was 17 years old, arriving in Philadelphia, looking really scruffy, and they're buying this bread and walking down the street munching it. And he says he passes by the house of his future wife, and he says she sees him, and he writes, she standing at the door saw me and thought I made, as I certainly did, a most awkward, ridiculous appearance. Now, the thing about that story is we have every reason to believe that it never happened. At least he did not pass by the house of his future wife who saw him. So you can admire on one hand his little bit of self-deprecation, and on the other hand you wonder, well, what exactly is this story about? What was his purpose in telling the story that way? Because it probably indeed didn't happen that way.
Well, first of all, we're not sure it didn't happen. I mean, he certainly does walk up Market Street that day. We know the boat he landed on. We know he was poor. We know he straggles up Market Street. And we know that she lives on Market Street. So I wouldn't dismiss the possibility that it's there. And, of course, he's spinning this image to show himself being his poor and humble roots. Because unlike most Americans at the time, he was proud of having been, you know, born poor and made a success of himself, you know, this rags-to-riches tale that later on became part of America's values. And if you want to understand that that scene in the autobiography, you probably have to look at the first two words of the autobiography, which are, dear son, because he's writing it much later, in 1771, to try to remind his son, who's become very pretentious and aristocratic and royalist, to remind his son of his humble roots and say, remember where you came from. We're not part of an aristocracy, and we're not trying to create an aristocracy in this new world or recreate the class system of the old world. So be proud of your humble roots.
Yeah. It is remarkable when you think about where he started where he ended up, being the son of a man who was a tradesman. He had a large number of children. Franklin didn't get much in the way of formal education, and he became, among other things, probably the best-known scientist of his time, not only here but also in Europe. That's a big jump from where he started.
His time. He became the best writer of his time. He became the best diplomat we've ever had in America. He became the most important philanthropist and civic leader, and one of the most practical political thinkers we've ever had. And you're right, he does it without a formal education. I mean, here's a guy, his father was going to send him to Harvard because his father wanted him to study to be a minister. Now, Franklin wasn't exactly cut for the cloth, and he's age 12, and his father, they're salting away all the provisions for the winter one evening, and Franklin says, how about if I say grace over him right now, and we can get it done with once and for all for the entire year? And so his father realizes it would be a waste of money to send him to Harvard, and so he apprentices him to his brother's print shop. And in some ways, that was a great education as well, because he pulled down all the books from the shelves and started reading Plutarch's Lives and Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress and all those books that you and I were reading when we were age 12, and made himself a best self-taught person in the colonies. Mm.
And this was something that his identification with that craft is something that he held for his entire life.
Yeah, he was proud to be a printer. He felt that, you know, the flow of information and the flow of ideas were the backbone of a democracy and what empowered people to have their liberties. So at age 17, he finally runs away to Philadelphia and starts working as a printer in a print shop there, and he starts signing himself, B. Franklin Printer. And, you know, really, I guess it's almost 70 years later when he's dying in his 80s. He's still signing himself, B. Franklin, printer.
Hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Walter Isaacson. He is the author of a recently published biography of Benjamin Franklin, which is titled Benjamin Franklin and American Life. And it's published by Simon & Schuster. And it's fairly recently out, so if you're interested, you could head down to the bookstore to take a look at it. And on this program, questions, of course, always welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Something I think is interesting is that apparently until fairly recently, there wasn't a lot of interest out there in the world among readers in the Revolution. People seemed to be quite interested in reading about the Civil War and about World War II, but not so much in the Revolutionary period. And just recently, that seems to have changed. We've had a number of very successful biographies of others of the founders published, and we've actually had a couple years and at least one other that I know of Franklin published as we head to the 300th anniversary of his birth, 2006. And I guess I find this curious, and I wonder if you think about what you think about why it is that now suddenly people are becoming more interested than they have been in the past in the Revolutionary period.
I think it was a time when our country had a great leadership group, you know, a great group of leaders who understood the need for nonpartisanship, for coming together and finding common ground, and for rejecting sort of the fanaticism or fundamentalism that was so pervasive around the world in order to create a society that was tolerant, and especially tolerant of different religions and different tribes, a pluralistic society, because as they understood democracy, and that in order to have a democracy that works, you have to have a tolerant, pluralistic society where all people are considered having the right to be part of society. We've kind of lost that in the 90s. We got beset with fundamentalism and fanaticism and people who thought that they had the guided way from the Lord or something. And I think that there's a rising tide of people who are yearning for good values and even spiritual values, but spiritual values based on humility, based on the fact that you're tolerant of other people's spiritual values and other people's lives. And it was that tolerance that we began to lose in our politics when it became so fanatic at times, and likewise we're attacked by that around the world. So if you look at our founders, you have a great group of people. You have somebody like George Washington, who is revered and respected, a man of great authority. You have people like John Adams and Samuel Adams who are unbending in the pursuit of their principles. You have great philosophers like Jefferson and Madison. And then you have a guy like Benjamin Franklin who can hold them all together. He's older than the rest of them, 30, 40 years older than most of the people I just mentioned. But he's the guy who can say to them, look, compromisers may not make great heroes, but they do make great democracies. We've all got to work together in order to have a democracy that respects everybody's rights. And I think there may be times when we're on crusades and we feel that reading about the Civil War or World War II helps embolden us, just like there are times in our lives when we're reading Shakespeare, we find Henry V to be the play that we should be reading the most. But nowadays, I think going back to the revolutionary period, with its enlightenment, its sense of practicality, its sense of scientific understanding, and its sense of tolerance, is capturing what we need these days.
We have a caller. Authors would be welcome to call into the show. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Caller here is in Bloomington, Indiana, and on line number 4. Hello.
Hi, I'd like to correct a misconception. You just said that Ben Franklin tried to spread tolerance, tried to introduce tolerance because the fundamentalist Christians weren't very tolerant. Wrong. Let me quote Patrick Henry. You remember Patrick Henry?
Yes, sir. I'm not sure I said fundamentalist Christians weren't tolerant. I think that there are fanatics and fundamentalists who aren't tolerant, however. But go ahead, sir.
Okay, here's what Patrick Henry said about, by the way, he was a fundamentalist Christian. And he said this: it cannot be emphasized too strongly or too often that this great nation was founded not by religionists, but by Christians. Not on religions, but on the gospel of Jesus Christ. And then he says, now listen to this, for this very reason, peoples of other faiths have been afforded asylum, prosperity, and freedom to worship here. Very
right.
Tolerant.
I don't know that quote from Patrick Henry. I do know that both Franklin and Washington and Jefferson and others were more deists. They didn't emphasize a particular dogma or a particular creed. And they felt that, as Franklin put it, the most important thing we learn from God is a certain sense of humility and a sense that he would want us to love all of his fellow creatures because he loves them all.
And oh, indeed.
Franklin.
There's no doubt about it. But let me correct you. Washington was not deist. You read some of Washington's prayers. They are the most evangelical prayers that you could find. And of course, it's just, you almost be inspired by reading them. At least,
yeah. Franklin wrote beautiful prayers as well. Franklin wrote his own prayer book, and they're very, you know, deeply religious people. I do think that they're deeply tolerant, and especially Dr. Franklin. During
Absolutely.
His lifetime, Franklin donated to the building fund of each and every church built in Philadelphia.
Extremely
and,
tolerant.
Wait. Sorry?
I said they're extremely tolerant. Of course
right.
they are.
Let me finish my tale, if you don't mind,
sure,
sir, unless you want to stop me. At one point, they were building a new hall in Philadelphia and for itinerant preachers. And he wrote, he was writing a fundraising thing. He said, even if the Mufti of Constantinople were to send somebody here to preach Mohammed to us, we should be tolerant, we should open our ears, and we should have a place for them to preach. And right before he dies, he was the largest individual contributor, one of three, to the Mikveh Israel Synagogue, the first synagogue in Philadelphia. And so at his funeral, instead of his minister marching with him to the grave, all 35 ministers, preachers, and priests of Philadelphia and the rabbi of the Jews accompanied his casket to the grave because he wanted to emphasize in a pluralistic society the need to be tolerant of all faiths and all dogmas and all religions.
Yeah, you know, that's very that's timely for you to say that. One of the people who respect and love the Jews probably more than any other people right now are evangelical Christians, where the world is being anti-Semitic. And by the way, David had a program just, what was it, yesterday, David, on
Friday.
Anti-Semitism?
Friday.
Was it Friday? Yeah. Mm. Evangelical Christians love Jews, are tolerant of them. Do we ever respect the Jews, and do we ever learn from them? Because they know the Bible, they know some things about the Bible that just instruct us. Anyway, I just wanted to make that contribution. And you got an interesting program.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you so much.
Let's go to someone else here. We're back where we are in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was just wanting to comment about the definition of all the people, speaking of Franklin and those leaders, making things right for all the people. And, of course, they were tolerant for their times. But all the people has been redefined now to include women and blacks and so forth. And I wonder if you want to comment on that.
That's probably the most important point to understand about our democracy, which is that there has been a relatively steady, although at times fitful, progress to including more and more people in the concept of we the people. And that's the notion of empowering people or tolerating individual liberties. Franklin was one of those people who had to wrestle with it himself. He was very somewhat enlightened when it came to women, and he believed in educating women, and he often wrote under the pseudonym. His very first pieces are written under the name Silence Duguid, because he was writing as the wise woman, etc. But you're right, they did not give women the right to vote in the Constitution, even though Franklin was much more tolerant of women's rights than other founders. Likewise, during his lifetime, early in his career, and in his mid-career, Franklin owned two slaves. And he allowed the advertising of slavery in the Pennsylvania Gazette, his newspaper. And then he realizes that this is appalling. Obviously, he frees his slaves, but he spent his life fighting tyranny and injustice, and he realizes how appalling slavery is. And you have to wrestle with slavery when you wrestle with the founding of this country and when you wrestle with the founders. And Franklin wrestled with it. And so not only does he free his slaves, but he helps form schools for freed blacks in America. And then at age 84, after the Constitutional Convention, he decides he has to embark on one last crusade to make up for this horrible blot in his character, which is having tolerated slavery during his early years. And so he becomes the president for the Society of the Abolition of Slavery and helps create committees for employment opportunities and mentorship and education, as well as petitioning and fighting for the abolition of slavery. So these are very flawed individuals, but they wrestle, and that's why at the very beginning of the show we were talking about this man is flesh and blood. He's not a saint, and he made mistakes, and he tried to wrestle with them. And when it comes to leaving people out of our democracy, they did that at the beginning, and part of the inspiring nature of the American tale is more and more people over the years get to participate in what we call We the People.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. On again to another caller. This is someone in Champaign in line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Isaacson, I want to thank you very much for the book. I found it to be extremely interesting and fascinating. It's an excellent job. Daniel Borstein, the historian, discusses Franklin's scientific endeavors as being very American in that he was taking an empirical approach and not being bogged down with theory as Europeans were at that time. And that as he became, according to Borstein, as he became more involved with Europeans, he abandoned his scientific approaches in the experimental kind of empirical approaches more towards the European theoretical approach, and that was really where Franklin turned away from science about that time. Did you see that in your research? Do you agree with Borstein?
Yeah, I agree in part, and I also think Dr. Borstein is one of the greatest thinkers and writers we had assessing American history, and I found his work very useful. Franklin, as we said earlier in the show, never went to college, much less university or higher mm-hmm. education. So he didn't have the formal training in mathematics or physics or science at times. So he became a very practical scientist. Let's take electricity, for example. His electricity experiments come up with the most important theory of that time, of the 18th century, which is a single fluid theory of electricity. And it shows that electricity is not two different fluids, as people had thought, but one flow from positive to negative. Franklin even gives us the names we use for it, positive and negative and plus and minus and condenser and battery and stuff. But unlike Newton, he wasn't a great theorist. In fact, he even said of Newton, you know, Newton gives us great theories about why gravity works. Because Newton had done for gravity in the 17th century what Franklin does for electricity in the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
But Newton had given us a great theory about it. And Franklin said, well, that's all very pleasant, but you don't really need the great theories in order to know that if you let go of a plate, it'll fall to the ground and break. And it's fun to know the theory, but you can save your plates and your crockery from breaking even if you don't know the mathematics and the theory behind it all. He said the most important thing is to try to find a practical use for the theory of electricity. And he, you know, had been knocked out by shocks and everything else, and he said after 2 years he writes to his friend in London. He says, the main problem we have is that we haven't found a practical use for electricity. In fact, the only practical use so far is that it tends to make a vain man humble. He was referring to the fact he kept getting shocked and knocked out. Of course, he did store up a lot of electricity in his battery and use it to kill the turkeys that they ate at the end of the season feast. And he said that the turkeys were uncommonly tender. So those of us who are from the South like to think of him as the inventor of the fried turkey. But eventually he understands what he calls the wonderful nature of pointed metal objects, which is that if you bring a pointed metal object that's grounded near a ball that's charged up with electricity, it'll draw the electricity away from the ball. Even if it doesn't touch the ball, it'll draw the electrons away from the highly charged ball. And from that, he comes up with the idea to have a lightning rod, because he realizes that lightning is really just a discharge of a spark from a highly charged bottom of a cloud. And if you have a lightning rod, a pointed metal object, it'll draw away the charge. And so he does that, and it becomes the most important and practical invention of his time. And the Royal Society and everybody else loves him for it. Now, there are many reasons he sort of floats away from science after that. And one of them, as you say, is that he got a little bit more enmeshed in theory and he wasn't quite as practical. I think the main reason is he got more enmeshed with public affairs and policy. He becomes a diplomat in England and then editor of the Declaration of Independence. He's at the Continental Congress, and some of the electricity experiments fall by the wayside because, as he said to one of his friends, the most important advances in science are not nearly as useful to people as the most important advances in society and government. Mm-hmm. And it would be more important for him to become a statesman than a scientist.
But he was still tankering at that time, the oil on water experiment.
I love the oil on water stuff. And it was a metaphor, by the way, in my mind at least, for his statesman things.
Mm-hmm.
There he is in England trying to settle this agitated seas between America and Britain, trying to calm things down. And he loves playing with the fact that if you drop a little drop of oil on troubled waters, it'll settle the waters down. Of course, he could never do the drop of oil on water that settled the troubles between America and Britain. And he was mainly tinkering, I think is the word you used, and yeah. I think that's exactly right, with
yeah.
science after that.
Well, how did we come, this is my final question, then I'll leave it open for other but how did we come with this image of Franklin as an old man with these electricity experiments when he was fairly young when he was doing it?
Yeah, he was what, 1750s? He was in his 40s. And there's a. You know, why do we think of him as an old man? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, we have these images of Franklin.
That bad picture that Benjamin West drew of the
yeah.
old guy with the flowing hair. Benjamin West paints it in the 1810s, 1815 or so. And he comes, and it makes it look like old Franklin is in his 70s and is some sage looking ridiculous flying a kite in the rain. When, of course, he's younger than me. He was a, you know, younger middle-aged guy, a Philadelphia tradesman when he did it. I think, you know, one problem is we always think of Benjamin Franklin as old, because by the time of the, you know, Declaration of Independence and all, he's 70 years old. We forget that he was a young man once. We forget he was a 30-year-old once and really good-looking and, you know, barrel-chested and strong, and that's when he was doing his electricity experiments.
We talked back at the beginning about the fact that various points in American history, people have been down on Franklin, and particularly because they said he overemphasized making money. But one thing that's true is that Franklin, while he was very successful as a businessman, retired at a relatively young age when he was 42, I believe, and then at that point decided to devote himself to to public life. What do you think was behind that
decision? Well, I did mention the letter his mother wrote. He wrote his mother. When his mother questioned him there, he said, "I'd rather have it said of me that he lived usefully than that he died rich." I think Franklin really did. He was about the most civic-minded person you'll ever meet. Here's a guy who, as I said when we were talking about religion, believed that the best way to serve God was help all of God's fellow creatures, because God must love them all, so let's help them all. And he felt that he had run away from the Puritanism of Massachusetts with its doctrine of salvation through God's grace alone, because he embraced the doctrine of salvation through good works. He believed that the best way to serve God and the best way to achieve salvation was through good works on this earth. And so I think that was a great motivating factor in making him help start, you know, everything from the first fire patrol, the first police patrol, Lending Library, the University of Pennsylvania, to help get people to sweep the streets of Philadelphia and stuff. He just wanted to make life better for his fellow citizens.
The other thing and that I wanted to have you talk a little bit about is the criticism perhaps some people have made of Franklin, that he came to the Revolution a little late, or at least maybe later than some of the others, and that he at before that had seemed to be interested in trying to have make some kind of accommodation between...
You know, as I said of Franklin, he was a guy who felt you could always have common ground, but if you just worked on it hard enough, you could find some accommodation, some compromise. And he's sitting there in England, you know, through the 1760s, trying to patch things up, and even into the 1770s. Even as late as Christmas of 1774 and the beginning of 1775, he's playing chess with Lord Howe, and he's playing his sister and meeting with Burke and others to see if he can work out some compromise, because he thinks of the British Empire as a fine, noble China vase, he called it. And once it gets cracked, you'll never put it back together again. And his solution was to have an American parliament or Congress that had sovereignty over America, and a British parliament that had sovereignty over Britain, and both would be loyal to the crown of England, and they would both have sovereignty in their own respective areas. And he thought you could work out a compromise in that regard. But finally he gets humiliated, and he comes back in 1775 and joins the Revolution.
We're coming into our last 15 minutes of the program. Our guest is Walter Isaacson. He is the author of Benjamin Franklin and American Life, a recently published biography of Ben Franklin, published by Simon & Schuster. Mr. Isaacson himself is president of the Aspen Institute. He's also been the chairman of CNN and managing editor of Time Magazine. And questions welcome. We have some people here. Again, it'll help us if we're brief, because if we're going to get everybody in, we got to kind of move it along here. We'll start out with Champaign County and line one. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I will be. We'll try to be brief, and I won't digress like our fundamentalist friend. I had the occasion to hear a quote from Benjamin Franklin given by the Alabama Chief Justice, who was just relieved of his position, and he was using it in the same fashion that our fundamentalist friend would to show that he was godly. And it was, I don't know if you're familiar with the quote. It was, He is reputed to give it to the Constitutional Convention, and he was calling on the power of prayer and meditation, and calling them back to their roots. Are you familiar with that quote at all? Or?
Oh, absolutely. He made a nice speech at the Constitutional Convention when they were tearing each other apart, saying maybe if we started with a little bit of a prayer, it would help us in our deliberations.
My opinion is that he was probably being a diplomat, which means not really saying what he meant, but just basically trying to know who the audience was and saying, you know, maybe...
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question, and I won't try to go on too long because I know we have lots of others. It's in the book. I spend a lot of time wrestling with it. He believed in God. He did not believe in what you call special providence, which is prayers for specific things. He felt that was being a little bit too arrogant to think you could pray to God to, say, make it stop raining or help us with this Constitution. But he believed in what was called a general providence, that there was a God who cared about us all and looked over us all, and we owed him devotion. And I think the reason he called for prayers at the convention was not for a specific prayer saying, get this done or that done, but just to remind people to have a little bit more humility and be a little bit calmer. And it was a way to get people to think that they were in the presence of a God greater than themselves, and not a specific religion or a specific dogma, but just to calm things down at the convention because it was becoming so heated and bitter.
Well, that might happen when you have Richard Pearl at your Aspen Institute. I don't know whether you, I don't suppose you were relieved of your position because that infamous quote or memo that you sent about to portray the efforts of our military so well. I agree, I realize that's a digression, but I think you actually ought to be confronted and asked about that.
Well, I believe in always covering things fairly and always putting things in context and always giving all sides.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I've tried to do as a journalist my entire career, and that's what I try to do here, which is, and that's what I think Franklin would have us do. He always said that if you always let all sides and you always put things in context, and any memo you're referring to, and I think I know the one you mean, it just said, let's put things in context and let's show all sides and not let's just focus on any one thing. And that's my creed as a journalist.
Sorry, I got to go.
People are smart enough.
All right. Well, obviously, there's a disagreement there, but we'll go on to the next caller, and that's line 3 in Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, I found Franklin's autobiography really difficult to read, but it was kind of nice to hear that he was such a swimmer and that he liked to sunbathe in the nude. Both of those points I thought were kind of fun.
But, yeah.
I wanted to know if...
Well, one thing you have to remember, is he was a fun guy.
Yeah, he sounds like it. I've wanted to know, he was there at the beginning, and when he looked south and west, and he saw the Spanish kind of doing an end run around where we would inevitably go. I mean, did he write much about that? Did he have much of an opinion about what eventually became Manifest Destiny?
Yeah, he felt that it was very important in the treaty we made with to end the revolution that nobody could hem us in. Neither the French nor the Spanish nor the British should make the Mississippi the final border of America. And he just felt that you were going to have an expanding American empire based on its values, and when there were thoughts that the Spanish or the French or the English even, he wanted to make the Mississippi, for example, open navigation for everybody.
Well, he didn't see any, I mean, that sounds a little problematic. I mean, if they
Well, he was somewhat partial to the French, but he got a treaty with the English as well as the French that was open and allowed for the expansion of America. He wanted to actually get some lands in the Western Territories and retire there, but he never quite did it.
So would you say he had some sort of antipathy toward the Spanish then, or...?
No, I don't think so. I mean, maybe I don't know enough about it. I know that he was very partial to the French, but you have to remember that France and Spain were allies in the Bourbon Pact Alliance, and, you know, allied by marriage as well as by the Bourbon Pact Alliance. And eventually he sort of entices Spain in on our side in the Revolution, even though France came in first without their Bourbon Pact allies. But I don't think he had an antipathy to the Spanish.
Hmm. Well, it just seems like the idea that he kind of thought that we should be expanding pretty freely kind of dispenses of all the problems of claimed land and territory and settlement.
Yeah, I don't think it was a particular problem with the Spanish. I just think he felt that America should and would and did. He was right. Expand generally towards the West as it grew as a nation, and that there shouldn't be too many limits on that expansion of America's, settlements.
Well, that's interesting. Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to another caller. This will be Champagne in line 2. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, I ran across a saying that I was familiar with, but I didn't know who I could attribute it to. And I found out it was attributable to Benjamin Franklin. It was a part of a missive he wrote to someone, and it goes as follows: in this world, nothing can be said to be certain except death and taxes. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. Franklin had so many sayings. A lot of them come from Poor Richard's Almanac, and a lot of them come from letters. He loved maxims. Some of them, you know, were maxims that others had said before him, and he kind of polished them up or improved on them, like a penny saved is a penny earned. That had been said before, and same with early to bed and early to rise. But he kind of revised them and made them better. nothing is certain but death and taxes, or something else he said. They're about 200 or so, and that's why it's always fun to read them. It was a way to educate people and make them better citizens.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you for the
call. It was also amusing. I mean, you know, I guess he was the one who fish and visitors stink after 3 days, or he's a fool that makes his doctor an heir, or beer is God's way of telling us he loves us. So he had a lot of funny sayings as well.
He was criticized for not being a terribly good husband or father, and being someone who might have made a good friend. But even there, he wasn't always very good to his friends. Did he strike you as being someone who, at his depth, was emotionally a kind of a chilly guy?
He had some good friends, and he was particularly had some strong relationships with some women friends. But you're right. He had a somewhat cold and distant relationship with his family, especially his son. Well, it wasn't exactly cold. It was tumultuous. Mm. He had an illegitimate son named William. And unlike most men of the time, he took responsibility for his son. He raised his son. He educated William. And he brought William to England when I said they went over there to help negotiate the revolution. And Franklin stays very middle class. As I pointed out, that autobiography scene is, you know, very middle class, you know, rags to riches type thing, hard work. Whereas his son becomes very aristocratic and pretentious and loyalist and becomes a royal governor of New Jersey. And when he comes back in 1775, Benjamin Franklin comes back and joins the revolution, he tries to talk his son William into joining the revolution with him, to resigning as royal governor. But William won't do it, and they have this horrible falling out and barely speak again. And it's made all the more poignant by the fact that William himself had an illegitimate son named Temple, and he didn't take responsibility for it, but Franklin did. Franklin raised this illegitimate grandson. And when 1775 comes along, this kid's 17, a beautiful young lad, and they are both, father and son, William and Benjamin Franklin, struggling for the soul and struggling for the loyalty of young Temple Franklin. And Benjamin Franklin wins, and Temple becomes his ally and secretary. So his relationships with his family were rather complicated. Once again, it's kind of human, though. Somebody out in some place was saying to me, gosh, you know, how could you, you know, deal with somebody who had such complicated relationships with his family? And I looked at this guy. I knew this guy. This guy was on his fourth wife. He didn't know the birthdays of half his children. I said, yeah, you ever know anybody like that? So, you know, you have to remember these people were real and not as bad as some of us are today.
He's certainly made a number of important contributions to the revolutionary effort and to the founding of the country, his involvement with crafting the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. I think some people might say that maybe the most important thing, or I don't know how you would rank this, was the way that he represented the United States to the French and secured their cooperation on the side of the Americans in the Revolution.
He's probably the last guy we had who knew how to deal very well with the French. They're a bit of a handful, as you know. But he tried to appeal to the ideals of the French, not just their national interests. In fact, he wanted to charm them and bring them and cajole them to our side. When he went over there, he realized that the French had read Rousseau, perhaps once too often, and thought of America as this backwoods wilderness, uncorrupted, natural, romantic man place. And so instead of wearing the ceremonial wig and the swords and the special coats and all that, Franklin wore a fur coonskin cap and a backwoods frock to pretend to be sort of the backwoods philosopher or the frontier sage, even though he hadn't really been to the frontier that often in his life. And the French absolutely adore him. The women are started to wear their hair in what was known as the coiffure à la Franklin, where they had it sort of done up as if it were in a coonskin cap, and they were wearing little medallions of them. The king even was so amused by all of this that he gave one of the women in his court a porcelain chamber pot with a Franklin medallion embossed on the bottom of it so that she could do whatever she wanted there. But the French end up adoring Benjamin Franklin. He becomes incredibly unpopular, and he espouses the ideals of the French, of the American, you know, belief in liberty and end of tyranny, and it helps get the French in on our side, which was crucial back then.
Way back at the beginning, we talked about the fact that perhaps more than any of the other of the founders, his image has gone up and down over time. That is, the way people have seen him is either having been a great American and embodying the values that we believe in, and then the next age will come along, depending on how things go, and they will say, no, that's not what we want to believe in. And it's sort of gone up and down that way. Mm-hmm. We're coming up to an important kind of milestone, that is, would be the 2006 would be the 300th anniversary of his birth. And at this point, it seems that, again, where his image is perhaps on the upswing. Do you think that that's always going to be the case, that Franklin is always going to be this kind of up and down in the way that people think about him?
Oh, I think so, because he's, as I say, somewhat of a mirror. We can either reflect or refract some of our own values. And, you know, there'll be times when I think we need a more heroic or passionate or romantic age, and we'll probably look at a Lincoln or some, you know, more tragic figure and revere him. But I think right now we need some practicality, we need some tolerance, we need a little bit of humility, we need the simpler virtues, have them restored back to our lives. And that's why we look at Franklin. He was also somebody who taught us how to lead a worthy life, a life that was useful to fellow citizens, a life that had spiritual meaning and certain values to it. And I think there are a lot of us that are yearning for that now who, you know, felt we've made too many compromises or trims in our lives. I know I've made a lot of mistakes, and I've compromised some of the things I felt. And so I wanted to go back to Benjamin Franklin and say, okay, how do you try to correct some of those things? How do you understand what's useful to your fellow citizens as opposed to just being more successful in a corporate career and that sort of thing? And, you know, these are the type of things that make people like Franklin, and there are different types of times when you probably don't need to worry as much about Ben Franklin.
Hmm. Well, there we'll leave it for now. And again, for people who want to read more on the subject, you can look for the book Benjamin Franklin, An American Life, published by Simon & Schuster, by our guest Walter Isaacson. He's president of the Aspen Institute. And Mr. Isaacson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so very much. It was a really interesting show, and all your callers were particularly interesting.